for what you're here for.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
We'll be live. Revolution will not be televised. Man, I'm here in the studio with Charlene Ellis, my guest co-host for today on Radio Basics. I'm Steve De Silva. How you doing, Charlene?
I'm great.
Man, we were just talking about how I just found out like half an hour ago that Gil Scott-Heron died, man. My heart was broken.
Dry.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I was unplugged for the weekend, so I just didn't hear.
I'm sorry. It's like, how could you, of all persons, not know that?
I don't know.
That most famous phrase appropriated by every hip-hop artist out there, which
appropriated,
is
appropriated, re-situated,
everywhere,
reapplied,
which is
the revolution will not be televised.
There you go.
It will be on the radio though, here on CHLY 105.5 FM. We got Charlene Ellis from Covered and Bound. Many of y'all may know her from her 4 to 5 p.m. show here on CHLY. She's joining me today, guest hosting. We're going to be talking about the issue of prisons policing and the conservatives' tough on crime agenda. We got a series of guests who are going to be coming onto the show with us tonight, as well as Charlene here in the studio with us. But prior to that, we got headlines. Provincial news. Ontario's progressive conservatives have pledged to turn prisoners into laboring chain gangs. Tim Hudak has pledged to make inmates work up to 40 hours a week as, quote, extra means to give back to society. Also in his campaign platform entitled Change Book, Hudak explicitly a pledge to, quote, bring public sector paychecks in line with private sector standards, end quote, which means basically break the unions and impose upon workers private sector insecurity, low wages, and slack regulations. It remained implicit in the new PC program that all sectors of workers would have to begin competing with the standards of the third sector identified in the platform, the free slave labor of prisoners, who would naturally begin to take on the jobs currently filled by both private and public sector workers. In federal news, dirty tricks from Canada's dirtiest oil industry. The federal government is now acknowledging that it deliberately excluded data from a report submitted to the United Nations on climate change on the fact that carbon emissions from the Alberta tar sands project increased by 20% in 2009. An article from the DominionPaper.ca from last week also revealed that the Canadian government has been aggressively pursuing a strategy to shelter its oil sands project from criticism in order to prevent its oil exports from being banned in Europe and Asia by environmental regulations higher than what Canada maintains for itself. The extraction of Alberta's bitumen, which is the world's second largest supply of oil after Saudi Arabia, is widely understood to be the most environmentally destructive extractive project in the world. In international news, a NATO airstrike in Afghanistan leaves 14 civilians dead. On Saturday night, May 28th, a NATO airstrike bombed the small farming village of Lashkar Gah in Helmand province, killing 14 civilians, all women and children. Five girls, seven boys, and two women were killed while they slept. The NATO occupiers alleged that the strike came after a nearby base came under attack by small arms. To Greece now, tens of thousands mobilized to block austerity measures. On Sunday evening, May 29th, Greeks mobilized for the fifth day in a row to protest the massive austerity measures that the Greek government is seeking to impose on Greek workers. Stephen Harper met with the Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou over the weekend during his G8 trip in Europe, and Harper endorsed the Greek government's austerity attacks on the people. The austerity package is part of the conditions accepted by the Greek government after it accepted loans from the International Monetary Fund, the financial body made up of 184 member states, to stabilize the international capitalist financial system. It was no surprise that Harper endorsed the austerity measures in Greece, not only considering the federal conservatives' own plans to impose austerity measures here in Canada, but also because Canada is the eighth largest financial contributor to the IMF, and also given that the Bank of Canada governor, Mark Carney, is currently seeking the presidency for the IMF in the wake of the scandal of the former IMF chief, Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Canadian imperialism has a direct stake in the austerity measures against Greek workers. And I understand Charlene is just loading up a track for us right now in tribute to the late and great brother Gil Scott-Heron. And many of you, this is the title track, really, of it speaks to his life, his career. You want to name it, sister?
Do you want him first? Because I could do him first.
What's that? Yeah.
Do you want Gil Scott first?
Yeah, please do.
Ele gua ashe 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 ele. It's not the title.
That's not the
phrase. No, we have to YouTube that bad boy.
You don't got it on?
No. Did you want me to? We can play something while I work it out. You see, you need me to be on the boards.
Yes, you got to take the boards.
Yeah, but we'll play.
All right, let's go to the track. We're going to be coming right back after this first track. We're gonna play some Gil Scott-Heron tracks throughout the show today, a tribute to the incredible artist who was Gil Scott-Heron. And when we come back from this first track, we're going to be speaking to Paul Amalia from the Center for Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives about a report that was written in late 2010 detailing the Conservative government's austerity measures. The track we're going to play right now is Revolution. This is off the Debbie Young album, Manifesto.
Woo Manifesto.
Oh, I didn't see that. The lights are dark
in
it. Woo Manifesto. And this is Revolution featuring none other than Assata Shakur. Check it out.
This is the 21st century, and we need to redefine revolution. This planet needs a people's revolution, a humanist revolution. Revolution is not about bloodshed or about going to the mountains and fighting. We'll fight if we are forced to. But the fundamental goal of revolution must be peace. We need a revolution of the mind. We need a revolution of the heart. We need a revolution of the spirit. The power of people is stronger than any weapon. Construction. Weapons of mass love. It's not enough just to change the system. We need to change ourselves. We have got to make this world user-friendly. User-friendly. Are you ready to sacrifice to end world hunger? To sacrifice to end colonialism? To end neocolonialism? To end racism? To end sexism? Revolution means the end of exploitation. Revolution means respecting people from other cultures. Revolution is creative. Revolution means treating your mate as a friend and an equal. Revolution is sexy. Revolution means respecting and learning from your children. Revolution is beautiful. Revolution means protecting the people, the plants, the animals, the air, the water. Revolution means saving this planet. Revolution is love.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Foster, and you're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM.
Greetings, Toronto. You're listening to Radio Basics, and we're back on CHRY 105.5. The topic of our show for tonight is policing prisons and the tough-on-crime agenda under neoliberal capitalism. What we'd like to do today is explore the links between the intensification of policing, the expansion of prisons, and in fact, the whole tough-on-crime agenda and the broader economic crises of capitalism. And to start our show off today, we'll be speaking with Paul Amalia, who is the author of the November 2010 report, The Fear Factor, from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, which details the federal conservative government's tough-on-crime legislation during its two minority governments, and now she'll be telling us a little bit about what we're going to be expecting with the conservative majority. Malia practiced criminal law for 15 years in two provinces, acting as defense counsel in Toronto, Kingston, and Brandon, Manitoba, and as a prosecutor in Kingston. During her time in Kingston, she represented many penitentiary inmates and has a broad knowledge of the prison system, both provincial and federal. She is a research associate with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and is expanding her recent report for publication as a book in the fall of 2010. Paula, thank you very much for being on the line with us tonight. So,
you're welcome.
I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about, give us a summation of the fear factor of this report that you wrote.
Okay, thanks. It has to do with the fact that in the past few years with the minority governments, the Harper government has brought down legislation, a lot of legislation on crime, mm-hmm. making us all wonder what that's about, because our crime rate is actually falling and has been for 20-some years. In the past year, for example, about 40% of the legislation related to crime. And if you look carefully at it, the legislation isn't actually directed at preventing crime or trying to deal with people before they commit crimes or anything of that sort. It's really almost all about sentencing, mm-hmm. and it all has to do with sending people to prison for longer and creating worse conditions and harsher conditions for them while they're there. The results of which will be, of course, a lot of human misery and a huge cost in financial in terms. So that, for example, one single piece of legislation that they passed a year or so ago is probably going to more than double the cost of the federal correction system over 5 years. That's billions. That's another $5 billion for
and
one
which, piece. Which pieces of legislation is that?
That's the one that has to do with dealing with people in doing remand time. People who are unable to make bail are now no longer able to be credited for additional time. In
yes.
other words, if they spend one day in remand, that's all the credit they get for when they're sentenced, which results in an inequity in terms of who does what time, but also is going to increase the amount of time that every inmate pretty much spends in prison, and that's going to cost a huge amount of money, which nobody really calculated, and they all voted for this in Parliament without having any numbers. Mm-hmm. And they're still being asked to do that, which is one of the reasons the government fell, was that the Harper Conservatives refused to divulge those fees, mm-hmm. the amount of money that would be involved. So the situation that we find ourselves in now is, of course, there's a majority government, so that nothing anyone does can prevent them from passing the legislation they want to pass. And they have promised that within the first 100 days of this administration, they will pass an omnibus bill that will include 11 pieces of crime legislation from previous years. Some of them mm-hmm. are very dramatically increased sentencing provisions, and that's of great concern.
So for the sake of our listeners, just to expand a little bit, an omnibus bill means what exactly?
It just means they've got all these bits of legislation that floated around for 5 years that they didn't pass for one reason or another, mm-hmm. and now they have the power to do so. And they will put them all together in a single bill mm-hmm. and push the whole thing through within 100 days. Among those pieces of legislation, I'll just raise a couple that are of
sure,
great concern
please.
To me. One, and will be to your readers. One has to do with mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses. And they're extremely draconian. They send people away for a very long time. They will send a lot more people away. And there will be no room for a judge to exercise any discretion with respect to those minimum sentences.
No judicial...
No, this what it does is it removes from judges, and much of the legislation involved here will remove from judges any ability to adjust for an individual's circumstances or for the circumstances of the crime. So, you know, one size fits all, and what that means is that we end up with a situation much like the one in the United States right now, where thousands and thousands of people are in jail. It's bankrupting the states individually, and even the very hard right wingers of the U.S. System, such as Newt Gingrich, who will be a name familiar to your listeners, are now taking the position that we have to stop incarcerating so many people. It's costing an arm and a leg, and it's counterproductive because it produces offenders who are more likely rather than less likely to reoffend.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow the Harper government seems to have missed this point, and they're pursuing an agenda that has proven to be bankrupt in every way south of the border. So it's a very strange approach.
So are there any other points to that on this bill that you wanted to address? Any other?
Yeah, one of them has to do with young offenders. Mm-hmm. Canada did a thing about a little under 10 years ago that has been remarked upon around the world as a very useful, sensible, workable way of dealing with young offenders. And part of what they did was just stop incarcerating so many kids. So over those years, from 2003 to now, we're incarcerating 42% fewer youngsters, and yet our crime rate is stable. It's static. This is one of the pieces of legislation that has shown us that you can incarcerate as many people as you want, and the likely effect upon the crime rate will be zero. The crime rate relates to a whole lot of other factors that have nothing to do with who or how many people are in custody. In any event, the new amendments to the young offenders legislation put forward by this government will roll all of that back. It wants to treat more young offenders as adults, and the bottom line on that is that they go to jail for more of them go to jail and more of them go for longer, thereby, you know, basically removing all the advantages that we've gained over the years from what we've learned. It's an approach that has little to do with evidence and everything to do with some approach to crime and criminal justice that it leans very heavily towards punishment and retribution.
Yeah.
And really isn't thinking very hard about rehabilitation or treating problems before they become criminal offenses.
As a final point of analysis, then, you know, for a lot of Canadians, a lot of people with these facts in hand, this may not make sense. It's going to cost tens of billions of dollars more. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost so much more misery to families, to you know, to the people who are actually incarcerated, become inmates, who are serving longer sentences. Increased recidivism seems to be a consequence of these sorts of more punitive, retributive policies. So how do you assess why this is occurring, and what, how does this reflect the broader agenda or interests of the current federal government?
It's a mystery to me why they go in this direction when all of the evidence goes the other way. There seems to be a need to punish, and I don't know where that comes from. You may have knowledge that I don't, but it seems to reside within the personalities in government or within the ideology that's driving the party right now. It certainly is a popular move for a lot of people, and that's largely because the general public has no first-hand knowledge about crime because most of us haven't touched it up close. And all we know is what the general media have to say about it, which, of course, is a very skewed version of what's actually going on out there. So I think the other thing the public needs to know, if it's going to assess this properly, is that what leads to crime has to do with things as simple as and as complex as mental illness, addictions, illiteracy, homelessness, prior sexual abuse. All of those are the things that...
Unemployment,
that
maybe?
Yeah, unemployment. Sometimes it's the economy, not always, but that can be a contributing factor. And we know that those are the risk factors, and that's where our hard-earned tax dollars should be going. It would cost far less it would be far more effective, and, you know, it would also be a really humane thing to do. These are people who have real problems, and we should be dealing with those. You have, however, and I'll just end on this note, the conservative government has been very clear that they don't believe in big government. They believe in dealing with defense and policing and prisons and those issues, security issues. They do not believe in funding social programs. And so you see where that takes us. If they won't do that, then you have a ready-made coterie of people who are going to wind up in prison.
and also a much larger government in other ways. Many more police on the streets, many more justices on the bench, many more prisons. That is very big government.
It is big government in a way that doesn't serve
the people, but serves the people in a different way, if you want to, for a play on words, I mean.
Yeah, it is a play on words, and we really need to get beyond that, because what's at the bottom of all of this is that these are very complex issues, and they don't deserve simplistic solutions. And sending everyone to prison, which is really what this is about, is extremely simplistic, and it's going to cause a whole lot more problems. So, you know, people need to get themselves informed and start standing up for something here, because right now the only thing that's going to deter the government from taking this path is moral suasion, and that requires people to get on their hind legs and start to make some noise about it, because otherwise it's done. It's a done deal.
Things are not going in a good direction. Thank you so much, Paul Amalia, from the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. Thanks for being on the show with us tonight.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
All right, good night.
Bye.
That was Paula Malia of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. She's a research associate there, and she practiced criminal law for 15 years. So let's check out that track, and we'll be back with the next segment of our interviews for the night.
The east to the west, human rights is under arrest. When the people protest, put democracy to the test, they divide and conquer, use homophobia to oppress one another. Same way they use gender, shadism, rank and order. From the USA to Burma, Afghanistan to Gaza, democracy is under arrest. And when the people demand the best, a place to rest their head, the right to get some bread, and enter the stress, cause their children deserve the best, what do? Them arrest. Fire. Plenty armies gather, birds have to scatter, the lizards and the tiger, scorch land and torture, charcoal and dust a smolder, plenty children without a mother, like ghosts in the night they wander, with cocaine and gunpowder. But sleep, sleep, sleep on, little child, let the morning sun caress your face, let it kiss your feet, make your body a holy place. Free from the factories and predators and the beat, selling their machines, philosophies, workologies. Sleep on, little child, sleep on. You deserve the best. How can we stand for anything less? Let them arrest. From Canada to Jamaica, Russia to America, human rights is under arrest. They control the press, and when the people protest, put democracy to the test. They divide and conquer, use homophobia to oppress one another. Same way they use gender, shadism, rank and order. From the east to the west, this planet is under distress. From the north to the south, human rights is under arrest. And when the people demand the best, put democracy to the test, they divide and conquer, use homophobia to oppress one another. We all want a place to grow, some land to sow, shelter overhead, some warmth, some bread. And when we protest, our children deserve the best. What do? Them arrest. Them arrest, but our souls will never die.
soul will never die. Demarest, but our souls will never die.
That was another track from Chet Singh, not the one that we had intended, inspired by Gil Scott-Heron, but clearly a track intended by and inspired by some of the issues that we're talking about here tonight.
Human rights.
That's right. Particularly the issues of policing prisons.
Arresting.
And the tough, the so-called tough on crime agenda. On the line with us tonight now is Dr. Rose Ricciardelli, who is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Liberal Arts and Policy Studies at York University here in Toronto. She earned her PhD in sociology at McMaster University, and Ricciardelli has a wide range of publications, and her research centers on gender identification and risk perceptions among men, and she has conducted extensive research dealing with conceptualizations of masculinity and as well as prejudice and stereotyping surrounding men in nursing as well as in prisons, and she's also looked into wrongful convictions. She's interviewed extensively men in prisons, mostly in the federal system, also a bit in the provincial system, but she's here to talk to us about some of those interviews. Rose is on the line with us tonight. How are you, Rose?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you so much for being on the show with us tonight.
So, oh, no problem. It's a pleasure.
You were preceded by Paul Amalia from the Center for Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, and we've been discussing the issue of policing in prisons on the occasion of this, a day after the provincial Conservatives have really unveiled this idea that or this platform and promise that they will basically bring in chain gangs into the provincial prison system. And the thing is, the reason I brought you on the show is because they're using this image of prisons as a hotel, basically a vacation, a home away from home for people to go, you know, who don't want to work, can't find a job, and are basically living it up in the prison system. But I understand your research maybe suggests otherwise. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you've done?
Well, I discuss the experience, the prison experience, with men who've served time in the federal system. Mm-hmm. So generally, the people I speak with, they do come out of the federal system. And the difference really between the provincial and the federal system, outside of the different level of government that runs the prison system, is that men in the federal system are in for an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. To be sentenced federally, you have to be in for at least 2 years.
More than 2 years, yeah.
Yeah, more than 2 years, where in the provincial system it's a bit more in and out. But many of the men that I've spoken with have also served time in the provincial system, mm-hmm. and then moved into the federal system. In speaking of the federal system, it's a little bit more complicated because there are different levels of prison. There's minimum, maximum, medium security,
yeah.
which sort of affects it. And a lot of time people group them. The Harper government tends to group prisons together rather than look at the different levels of prison.
Indeed. And I think the whole right-wing populist rhetoric around prisoners and inmates kind of just lumps everything together and probably takes very decontextualized bits of information to try to, conjure this image of the prison as a vacation where people are having it easy. So what does your research tell us, though?
Well, from what I've seen, it's really hard to understand this view of prison as this vacation or as a camp. If we're looking at more of a minimum security prison, it's sort of like a prison that has no fence. So men are in and they do head counts and they have a lot more freedom and liberties. But in order to be in a minimum security prison, they have to be in for an extended period of time, but on a crime that really is not that violent, or they've basically been serving a life sentence or at the very, very end of their sentence and have slowly moved their way down. If we look at where people start out, sort of thing, they all go to Millhaven or they go to Kingston Penitentiary in the beginning, and they're in, they're sort of in a temporary holding phase, and then most men go out to a maximum or a higher or a medium security. And if we're looking at what a maximum security unit is like the J unit at Millhaven, we're looking at men who spend 23 hours a day in lockdown. There's nothing like a vacation about it. There's no enjoyment. There's no relaxation. They sit in a cell all day long, often alone, and they get out for an hour to an hour and a half where they basically have time to either shower or make a phone call. So it's a much different view of prison mm-hmm. overall. Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us, I know you've done extensive interviews and research with many of the prisoners, and obviously you probably can't speak of any of the particular details, personal details, but can you tell us, can you characterize for us what life is like inside prisons for some of these men?
I think basically what the public doesn't understand is prisons are extremely violent. If you're looking at a higher level security prison, they're extremely, extremely violent. Shanks, and those are like handmade knives of some sort, run rampant. Individuals, particular individuals who are in there for crimes that people take offense to, crimes such as rapes or pedophilia and these types of crimes, they have to be in protective custody. They have to be away from the general population, and they have to fear for their lives. It's not a safe place to be. Everyone, no matter what they're in for, they talk about watching their back and being careful and being scared of violence. The media and the portrayals we have, it tends to be that there's a lot of rape in prisons, and that's not the case at all. What we're really looking at is people feeling that their lives are threatened. And even if you pay attention to the news, you'll see that there are a lot of murders and violent acts that are occurring in our prisons. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we see a lot of in prisons are suicides, attempted suicides, and actual suicides. And more often than not, this is a story of persons who have mental illnesses and are not getting the adequate medication they need, and as a result, they can't deal with the anxiety, or they their symptoms become exaggerated due to a lack of medication, and in the end, there's suicidal tendencies. Mm-hmm. So prisons are actually quite a scary place to be living, and men are in there day in, day out, and they never feel safe. They're always concerned for their lives, concerned for their well-being, concerned about what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely not a vacation.
I appreciate that, you know, your experiences are more at the federal prisons, and Tim Hudak is referring to provincial jails, but not only do I think a lot of people lump these things together, but also I think that whatever precedents are set at any level will be replicated where possible by those with similar types of agendas at other levels. So I think that what Tim Hudak and the Ontario PCs are proposing could become a more general trend if it's actually implemented and accepted. The last question I wanted to ask you is, you know, given that you've done this extensive research in prisons, what do you make of the extensive and increasing criminalization that's associated with the tough on crime agenda that's being applied really at all levels of government?
Well, I think it's not going to work. What we've seen is these decreased crime rates, and prisons were getting to be a more humanitarian, not necessarily even humanitarian. There's a lot of crime and it's getting violent, but we'll see that each year it's getting more and more violent. And when I'm talking to these prisoners or ex-cons, basically people on parole, so still on their warrant, they're explaining to me that they see the actual prison system, what's happening in the prisons. It's getting more violent. It's getting scarier. They talk about the criminals who are coming in, how they lack respect, how things are getting exaggerated, where people are participating in more and more crime, that there's a lot of overcrowding. And as a result, it's getting increasingly violent with every passing day. Almost half of the participants that I've spoken to have talked about how they believe that perhaps a riot is going to come just because of how close everyone is and the increasing violence. The other thing that I've learned also looking at provincial prisons, the people who've served time there, is provincial prisons are even more violent in comparison to the federal prisons. They have more people who are in there for shorter periods of time. There's a lot more on the range, like the area where the inmates are. There tends to be a dominant individual on the range, which and that person tends to have a lot of control. So we see even more violence in the provincial system.
Could you comment? I mean, you say you're characterizing prisons as becoming increasingly more violent, and I think that characterization can be viewed from a variety of perspectives. So I want to tease that out a little bit more. Do you mean that is it merely that the individuals coming in are more violent and are becoming more violent, or what extent does this have to do with the prison conditions themselves and the actual makeup of the prison institution?
The prison conditions are going to fuel the violence. A lot of persons I've spoken to, they say they go in and, you know, they go in for like importing or selling drugs or something, often to do with addiction and fueling money to provide for their addiction. Mm-hmm. And they say that they walk out a murderer and commit more crimes when they're in there because they have no choice. It's one thing if someone's coming at you with a shank and you retaliate, you've actually hurt someone in a way you would never have done on the outside. So we really have, and a lot of people are learning more about criminal behaviors when they're in prisons. Mm-hmm. And the close quarters and the need to have to stand up for themselves or get beaten up more or used in more inappropriate ways is really a threat that these men experience. And mm-hmm. most men that I interview discuss the fact that they leave prisons having committed more criminal acts than they would have on the outside. And it's really a means of survival when they're in there. I don't think we can understand what it's like to actually fear for our lives on a day-to-day basis. You know, they talk about how they'll be walking out in outside and someone will be attacked or stabbed, etc., and they have to walk right over them because if they do anything, if they bend down to help that individual, they know they'll be next. So it's a completely different mm-hmm. environment that I think more often than not we can't understand being where we are and having the freedoms and the liberties that we have. We also have to understand that the people who are serving the time in prisons, especially the harsher sentences, mm-hmm. may not have the same resources that many other people in society do. And as a result of that, they're serving their time in prison.
Mm-hmm. So certainly not a rehabilitative environment, and certainly, at least in the case in the federal institutions you're talking about, not a vacation where everybody's sitting around watching pay-per-view television.
Oh, definitely not. Yeah. The other thing that we have to know, if we were talking about rehabilitation, I've talked to many, many men who want to learn to read, who want to do university programs, who want to improve themselves when they're in there, and they don't have the opportunity at all. Mm-hmm. They can apply for courses, but they can't get anyone to invigilate an exam. It takes months and months for books to arrive. And in the provincial system, there's even less chance of that because mm-hmm. they're in there for shorter periods of time. Mm-hmm. There's no rehabilitation at all in there. There's some trials and there's some, but there's really not enough. I shouldn't say there isn't any, but there isn't enough. Mm-hmm. And the men in there, they want it. They want to change. Many, many want to change and come out as different individuals. Mm-hmm. And many of them that I speak with, they don't ever want to go back, and they'll try to do anything they can to stay out again.
Mm-hmm. But clearly, by the description, by the conditions that you're describing, it makes it very difficult for them to stay out of trouble.
It's hard when they're in prison to stay out of trouble, and when they come back into society, it's not set up. But that's a whole other discussion about the different parole policies, etc.
Yeah. Rose, thank you very much for being on the line with us tonight.
Oh, I hope I was helpful in some way.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Good night.
Take care.
That was Rose Ricciardelli, who is an assistant professor here at York University in the sociology department. We're going to go to a commercial, and we'll play some more music, some more Gil Scott-Heron, and a tribute to the late, great musician. And we're going to talk with Charlene as well. We're going to continue this conversation here on Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5 FM.
Estás escuchando CHRY 105.5, tu estación de radio comunitaria. Escucha en vivo en nuestro sitio web www.chry.fm.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Mendel Rivers to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on reports from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lifes of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm Women Liberationists and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, or Engelbert Humperdinck. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised. Will not be televised. Not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
The revolution will be live. And if at all, it will be aired on CHOY 105.5.
It will not be
televised,
but it will be on radio.
It'll be on Radio Basics, yeah. Man, if they haven't taken us out by then.
No, they can't. Do you know how important radio was in terms of revolutions all over the world?
No doubt. No doubt. You don't.
Franz talked about that in his book, Black Skin, White Mask, how they needed radio. The Algerians needed radio.
Radio, yeah, it was a guerrilla form of communication.
For real.
Right? Before the monopolies took over the airwaves. In fact, you know, I'm with Basics Community News Service, right? Mm-hmm. An older brother, you know, like a real elder from the movement. You know, he's been involved in militant struggles in Canada since like the 60s, 50s. And he was telling me the history of radio in Canada, how in the early period, in the 20s and 30s, or maybe it was the 10s and 20s, the big monopolies really didn't know what to do with it. You know, and it was really a hub for community power.
For sure.
It was a place where the people controlled the airwaves. And then when the advertising industry blew up, right, then they started learning how they can creep in and take over and take control.
For sure.
And now we live in a city where with the fall of CKLN,
for sure,
we now have two, well, at least on the FM dial, they're still broadcasting.
Yeah, and there's us.
On the radio.
And over all cultures, as you just talked about, there's always that circle that happens around the radio. You can see that in your head, right? At all times, through every culture, something is happening. There's that circle of people sitting around listening to a radio, right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's not magic. For people listening in, you know, there was a little technical difficulty earlier in our show.
But
it's not magic.
Live.
We're not professionals, but we're real. We're
yes,
here.
We are professionals. We do this for love. That
we do this for love. It's even better. It's professional,
exactly.
You know, revolutionary.
Exactly.
Not professional. I'm getting paid 60K a year to come in and do this, and this is my job. And you know, this is what we do, what we love.
True.
What we've been talking about on the show here today, which you probably wouldn't have discussed on corporate radio, we've been talking about prisons, policing, and the so-called tough on crime, which, as the report of one of our guests who was on the show today, the Fear Factor, as she wrote in that report, tough on crime really is what she writes, lazy on crime, she wrote lazy on crime and not solving crime at all. Because tough on crime is just words. It's a red herring,
mm-hmm.
Right? What's really happening is, as the professor Rose Ricciardelli was talking about, is that they're not intending to solve, prevent, or resolve crime and criminality. The exceedingly punitive, retributive measures are making matters worse for all people, right? And I know, Charlene, you're involved with a lot of prisoner justice work. You're very much an abolitionist when it comes to the prisons, as certainly all of us are on Radio Basics.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing. I know you got a book program.
Is the books to prison programs through OPORG here at York, where as a group off OPORG, what we've been trying to do for the past year is send books to prisons. We feel just like your last guest was saying there, that how there's that need to rehabilitate, and they do want to learn. They do want to come out changed, in that if you give them the tools to change, they will. I don't think what she said is even made clear enough, that prisons don't address the basic issues that causes people to go to prison, like poverty, homelessness, racism, and oppression over sex and gender. All those things are not addressed. So therefore, you have these men in prison who come out becoming hardcore prisoners. Or so. So through books to prison, we've been trying for a year. It's been a difficult process, because getting books into prison has to go through all this red tape. So what we were trying to do was send the prisoners a list of books, because we feel that a place where you have no choice, if you were able to make a choice in terms of a book, it would make it even better for you. So we tried to send it in. It took a long time. Most of the time we end up sending photocopies of books or articles that they requested, only because there's this thing that if you send a hard covering, somehow they're going to take it and make it into a weapon. Yeah, a hardcover book. And not thinking that in able to expand the mind and rehabilitate, which is what they want to happen in prison, you need to give people things that will expand their mind. So through that program, but I'm also on a subcommittee of the Youth Justice Coalition, and it's a part of the prisoners subcommittee group, which works around prisoners justice. And one thing that was mentioned by Rose, the caller, the interviewer before, was around youth justice crimes. And I don't think if you're a parent like I am, and even if you're not, you should be aware that Bill C-4, which Harper was also trying to bring in, and we were fighting closely against for like a whole year.
Yeah.
Hoping that the election would have changed that. And what Bill C-4 was going to do was amend the Youth Criminal Justice Act to basically increase how young people are dealt with. And as she made it clear, crime has fallen.
Crime is actually, it's been on a downward trend for two decades.
It has. Youth crime especially.
Yeah.
I think what we have to be aware of is how the media tends to overblow things out of proportion. So you have
the media reporting on crime has actually been increasing while crime has actually been going down. So that must lead us to ask what are the interests of the corporate media and the conservatives and basically, you know, capitalism, what is the interest that they have in bringing in more criminalization when crime is actually going down?
PIC, that's
scaring
what it boils down to.
And what does that mean?
The prisoner industrial complex.
The prison industrial complex.
I mean, this for me personally as a woman of color, this is the new chapel. This is the new slave chapel that they're developing.
Yeah.
Like, because it's our young people.
Tim Hudak told us clear. He said, we're going to put these people to work 40 hours a week, right?
That's...
So let's just put the pieces of the puzzle together, like, right?
You've just solved the puzzle.
So you got governments at all levels, right? Right now it's happening at the intensely the local level, the federal level, even the provincial level under the Liberals. And sometimes where NDP is governing as well, they do it as well sometimes. And this is attacks on working class people.
Exactly.
It's coming in the form of austerity measures, so-called, where public sector unions are coming under attack. It's coming in the form of public assets being put on the chopping block and being sold for fire sale prices to private companies, to monopolies, right? And so while the...
Neoglobalism, can we say that?
I don't know. Sure, you can say it.
Yeah.
You can say it. It's neoliberal globalization.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's
Kwame Nkrumah, I think it was, that said that is like the last and worst stage of capitalism.
Neocolonialism, he called it, right?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
Was it Kwame Nkrumah?
Yeah, yeah. So this is it, people. I think what she pointed out to, just like you're saying, is like, come on, think. We need to have a moral, just like they're using it to kind of incite us to think that there's these prisoners sitting around living the large life.
Mm-hmm.
We need to attack the not prison thing morally, too. Get to people's emotions. This is not working. It's archaic. It's going to cost us more. That big debt that they're talking about, most of it is going to come from this.
A lot of it is going to come from this. A lot of it is coming from militarism.
Yeah.
A lot of it is coming from increased policing. Look, our own mayor here is saying that we got to tighten our belts, enough of the gravy train, whatever else he has to say. We basically have to cut down the budget. We got to look for $700 million. So tell me, why would you put an extra $50 million a year? You give an 11% pay raise to police officers while you're looking to attack everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's simple. I'm not going to ask rhetorical questions anymore. It's quite simple.
Straight up.
The police, the military,
yeah.
These are institutions that serve a very particular role mm-hmm. for the economic ruling class, for
That's
the elites.
It.
All we have to do is look at the G20.
That's it.
All we have to do is look to Afghanistan and Haiti. And what we see is that these are not neutral institutions. However nice of a guy or a woman this soldier or that officer may be, because we always hear that. People say, well, you know, there's some really nice people working there. But it says, you know what, this is when you're giving your command, you're giving your order, you do it or you get fired or
That's
you get
it.
Reprimanded.
Yeah.
Right? So people, we need to recognize what the role of these institutions are in our society so that we know how to confront them.
That's it. And You've said so much. I can't even add to that other than that the fact that we need to work on that moral, emotional part of it, whereas it's not going to help. Putting more people in prison is not going to solve the problem that causes people to go to prison in the first place, right? And it's about cutting those programs that we just talked about. What do you think they're cutting? Those social programs, right?
It will. We know it will lead to big contracts for big companies. It'll lead to more debts, which then can be used to justify dismantling our social programs, right? It'll lead to, from what Tim Hudak is telling us, free labor, slave labor amongst prisoners.
That's what it boils down to.
Who will then be doing work that paid labor, who public or private sector workers could or should be doing, right? So let's try to put these pieces of the puzzle together and see what's up, right?
It's all about the money in the end.
Yeah, so what are we going to do? What are we going to do, Charlene?
Try to play on people's emotion. I feel that being a part
of
the
conservatives are doing.
Yeah, no, as an abolitionist, in a different way. Yeah, to let people know that, to be aware that these are our children. And I hate when people say, well, not my child. Well, no, it affects every one of us, every single one of us. We have to realize that if they can play on our emotions, we need to play on their emotions and let them see that the facts are there. Crime has not risen. Bill C-4, we fought really hard as a working group to try and stall and make people aware of, and especially young people. Because if you can't vote, they can at least tell their parents, you know? Because they know that they're going to be affected. This is not something that you play with, like I said before. And it's not even about helping people rehabilitate at all. Because this is a financial burden, this debt that includes youth. And C4, it was made clear that C4 was not necessary. It was something that was brought about through a report done by Justice Nunes, which spoke on a horrific crime that happened in Canada. But his report did not say that increasing the likelihood of young people in prison would help. In essence, this report that he made, only a few points were brought about in defense of bringing Bill C-4 into effect. And what Bill C-4 really did was increase the use of prisons and the sentence and pretrial detention that are holding youth in custody before trial. There's a goal right now with the youth justice system to rehabilitate and reintegrate young people into the society. But judges are now able to be flexible. But once this Bill C-4 gets passes, all of that gets thrown away.
So we have a caller on the line.
Sure.
He'd like to make a comment. I believe he's a police officer. So he'd like to, I think, speak to some of the points that we're making. So we'll let him have a second. I believe you're on the line, sir. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Sorry, we're coming to the end of our show. We're at 9 o'clock, so I can only give you about 30 seconds, but please go ahead, make some comments.
Oh no, I just happened to the station, which I've been listening for pretty much forever and a day now, since the 80s.
Yeah.
And a full supporter of the station. Excellent topic you guys are discussing. The only thing I would like to take exception is it's where we're so hard and fast in terms of saying that police, military, that sort of institution, are pretty much out there just for the man, so to speak, and suppressing the little guys. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've been on the job for almost, 25 plus years now. Mm-hmm. Personally, I've never given an order or have an order given to me going out there specifically just to suppress, the little man, so to speak. We go out there and we do a job as best as we can with the tools that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I kind of take it. I know you're just, it's a blanket statement. You're just
okay.
I realize that.
Okay, well, I mean, we appreciate the comment and we'll continue to engage with the topic.
Yep.
Okay, thank you, sir.
No problem. Take care.
Well, we had a brother on the line. He was an officer. He was taking issue with some of the statements we're making. But I think, like the G20, like let's just start with the G20 issue, right? So the officer was saying that he had never given an order or taken an order that had to do with suppressing the people and so on and so forth. But I think we just look to the G20, for example, as one example among others, where if a
policing state,
right? So if officers were either given or not given orders to conduct the biggest mass arrest in Canadian history. Officers were either given or not given the order to bust up a lot of people, as we have with this Dorian, I think it's a Dorian Smith, right, where the other officers who were working with that officer will not identify him. So it's either that some officers are going off the deep end and doing some very egregious actions, which has led the Special Investigations Unit to conduct a lot of investigations and almost in all cases come up with no convictions, which has led the SIU to come under increasing scrutiny and criticism as a body that's indeed not very independent.
Again.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's either that officers are working unto themselves or that this has something more to do with the forces that control the police. I mean, the comment I was trying to make earlier is that police are not acting unto themselves. So to our previous commentator, this is not singling out the police, because I'm trying to situate the police mm-hmm. in relation to the state and the interests of the state. I'm not suggesting that corporations hand down an order and the police go and carry it out. No, they work through the executive command, mm-hmm. through the cabinet ministers, through the legislation, but more directly through the executive. Mm-hmm. That's where the command comes down through all levels of government.
And he made it quite clear that mm-hmm. he specifically, as an individual and a CHRY listener for some 20 years, yes. got to big him up for that.
For real.
Yeah, and he made that clear that he, as an individual, for after 25 years, he said, of policing,
yes.
was never given an order or told to. But as you're saying, it's a bigger issue, though.
Yes, it's not about individual officers.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, the culture of policing is, which we can analyze, criticize, scrutinize, which, I mean, in the case of this Dorian Smith, who all these officers will not, you know, will not speak out against their colleague who carried out these abuses against this individual. I mean, we can analyze that and as the culture of policing, but I'm actually talking about something much larger. And that is the issue of the understanding the nature of policing and police as an institution in relation to the executive command of the state. And there's no doubt that we live in a state that is increasingly servile to corporate interests, mm-hmm. to monopoly capitalism. So the police and the policing structures mm-hmm. are not a neutral body mm-hmm. in that situation. And we just have to look, I think, all around the world, whether it's, you know, in the United States with sheriffs evicting people out of their homes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are some very limited examples of police officers and sheriffs who have not evicted people, despite the gross and egregious injustices that are being carried out against people who are having their homes stolen from them, right? Whether it's police officers shooting people down in Yemen or mm-hmm. Syria or Egypt, mm-hmm. it's not
right here up the road.
Or right here, right, with Junior
yeah.
Manon
yeah.
last year here on York University yeah. campus.
Good point you made in that it's that state issue. I don't think we are having that realization of you having democracy taken away. G20 totally proved that. Like there was that point there where the people had no talk. I don't think people realize the extent of that power that happened mm-hmm. prior to that, during that, and after that. That you were stopped. My child was going home to Hamilton that same day it started, and he takes me back like they were deep at Union Station.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
And as a young man of color, he's like, ID out, because you were being stopped. Yeah. So that points to the power of the state. That's what you're trying to get to.
And it's not about individual officers. It's not even about the police institution as something unto itself. I'm not offering up a liberal analysis that is trying to view police and policing and the police institutions as some kind of institution unto itself. In fact, I personally don't even like to use the term police state myself, just because it then separates the police out from the rest of the state.
Yes, it
right?
Does.
And the rest of the state needs to be taken into consideration.
Okay. Because
right?
it's all, yeah.
What we saw with the G20 was the integration of all levels of policing, from exactly. military to CSIS to RCMP, right down to the local.
Steve,
and it was all united.
Yeah.
And that has a lot more to do with the executive command.
Deeper implications. Scary power.
Yes. So that's our show for tonight. We're certainly yeah. over our time.
One thing before we
yes,
go.
Yes, Charlene. Yes, Charlene.
And mentioning youth crime and policing of states.
Yes.
Tavis is on the board again. They've been given millions of dollars again to police the so-called priority neighborhoods, which is Jane and Finch. Yeah. I live in the Keelan Eglinton area. So there's a meeting tomorrow for community members
mm-hmm.
to get involved and question and ask and get answers about Tavis and mm-hmm. what they plan to do. And the meeting is taking place at the Hub, which is at Jane and Thrithui, Brown yeah. Bricks.
Okay.
And it's from 11 to 1 o'clock. I mentioned that neighborhood.
In the afternoon?
Yes, it okay. is. I mentioned the name and the connotation to that neighborhood because it's infamous in our criming and policing.
Mm-hmm.
And please, anyone who's in the community, who's concerned or just wants to hear more about what Tavis or question Tavis about what they are going to be doing this summer, they get millions of dollars to do it. Please come out to the meeting. It's at the Hub tomorrow, 11 to 1 o'clock.
Please come out. Meet other community members who are also
yes.
concerned.
Yes.
I find these meetings are often even better for the people
yes.
you meet at the meetings
yeah.
if the meetings themselves don't actually yeah. turn out to be too fruitful. So please come out to this Jane and Trethui.
At
the Hub.
Yeah, it's right where that supermarket used to be, right on Jane Street. And it's going to be huge. And we need everyone who is even questioning or who even doesn't mm-hmm. even know what Tavis is, who they are.
come and check that out.
Do.
And just to conclude, you know, Charlene Ellis, she's the regular host of Covered and Bound, 4 to 5 p.m. here in CHOY. But thank you so much for coming on Radio Basics. We got to make this a regular thing,
Yeah, it was kind of fun.
You're here, you're in the station already on Monday, so we should do this more often.
I'll hang out a little longer with you.
All right. Much love to Charlene Ellis. And I'm Steve DeSova here on Radio Basics. And we're going to check out Wasun featuring Detox. Fallen Angels. Anything else, Charlene?
Yeah, we're going to do some Gil Scott come back, right? Do you want to go out with Gil Scott or you want to play your
I want to play this track because it speaks to the issues we've been talking about tonight. And we're going to conclude, as long as we have time, until Vince walks in the door and takes on Every Day I Have the Blues, we're going to be playing Gil Scott Heron,
yeah,
man.
We have two
to pay much tribute and much love to that great brother.
62 passed on.
How do I even qualify him? Soul, hip-hop. He spoken word. Where do I even put him?
An jazz. Angry, yeah, it's just an angry young man who used the power of words to express himself in the 70s, and he's lived it. Everyone has been influenced by him at some point or another.
It's so sad to see him go because he just started reproducing music again, and he was coming out with new stuff.
Yeah.
You have some stuff?
We have two tracks from his new CD called I'm New Here by Gil Scott Heron. And let's play
We'll check that out. So first, Wasun and Detox, Fallen Angels. This is some grimy, revolutionary Toronto hip-hop. Check it out. Radio Basics, we're out for the night. Much love, Toronto. And thanks to all our listeners, including the brother who called in and offered up his comment. We appreciate
Much
the
respect.
Dialogue. Much respect to everybody. Good night.
Fallen angels, do spread your wings up. Black life, never know when those things bust. Spreading so much hate, why not bring love? And make so much cake if we build trust. Crack era's history, but there's still drugs. Gangster rap history, but there's still thugs. Filled with so much hate, but there's still love. Throughout the darkness, I see doves. At the funeral, thugs, mama still hugs. Did her best to bring the light out in us. For the love of paper, we reached the maker. Why you think families came from Jamaica? For a better life, build a house with acres. Sending barrels back home for the haters. Sending cake back home for the bakers. Slums where Dutta's from, call them neighbors. Detox, what about the fallen soldiers you came up with? They live in my music. Why the good gotta die young all of the time? When police kill a man, it ain't called a crime. They killed two of my friends and brutalized my mind. I've been bottling it up, time to taste the wine. Red rum with no chase, let you wake, I cry. Real G shedding tears, red rags of eyes. Babylon ain't got a license to take no lives. How you justify multiple shots versus knives? Sean Bell's spirit resurrected alive. When you call police for help, you ain't supposed to die. A revolution can be born when the dead resign. I'm feeling like I'm Bruce Willis, sixth sense divine. Some good gotta come out of this pain inside. Spread your wings, have faith, and always aim to climb. Keep your right fist raised in this maze of lies. Best way to fool the slave is make them think they're fine. They changed up the definition, gave us things to buy. So now we walk around free, but they enslave our mind. What happened to the Black Panther productive vibe? They used to be scared of us, now we fear them. Why? You can fully overcome what you face in time. You're the only one that knows your true worth divine. I knew six people murdered. This a prayer in rhyme. Every word is a wing flapping up in the sky. If you're alive, you can be awake and dream a design. Be the architect of life before you leave it behind. The art of war said to win without a fight, bring pride. But Malcolm said by any means, we should be on the rise. I'm tired of police victimizing citizens' lives. Dear pig, tell me what you see when closing your eyes. I take a negative and make a positive multiply. R.I.P. We can make it. Just believe you can fly.
Certain bad things that happen make you realize that you've been here a lot longer than a whole bunch of people thought you would. Because I always feel like running. Not away, because there's no such place. Because if there was, I would have found it by now. Because it's easier to run, easier than staying and finding out you're the only one who didn't run. Because running will be the way your life and mine will be described, as in the long run, or as in having given someone a run for his money, or as in running out of time. Because running makes me look like everyone else, though I hope there will never be cause for that. Because I will be running in the other direction, not running for cover. Because if I knew where cover was, I would stay there and never have to run for it. Not running for my life, because I have to be running for something of more value to be running and not in fear. Because the thing I fear cannot be escaped, eluded, avoided, hidden from, protected from, gotten away from, not without showing the fear as I see it now. Because closer, clearer, closer, nearer, because of you, and because of that nice that you quietly, quickly be causing, and because you're going to see me run soon, and because you're going to know why I'm running then, you'll know then, because I'm not going to tell you now. Life has been guided, and all the love I needed was provided. And through my mother's sacrifices, I saw where her life went. To give more than birth to me, but life to me. And this ain't one of them cliches about black women being strong, because hell, if you're weak, you're gone. But life, courage, determined to do more than just survive. And too many homes have a missing woman or man. Without the feeling of missing love. Maybe there are homes that are hurt, but there are no real lives that hurt will not reach, but not broken. Unless the homes of soldiers stationed overseas or lost in battles are broken. Unless the homes of firemen, policemen, construction workers, seamen, railroad men, truckers, pilots who lost their lives, but not what their lives stood for. Because men die. Men lose, they are lost, and they leave, and so do women. I came from what they called a broken home, but if they ever really called at our house, they would have known how wrong they were. We were working on our lives and our homes, dealing with what we had, not what we didn't have. My life has been guided by women, but because of them, I'm a man. God bless you, Mama. And thank you.
Jagged jigsaw pieces tossed about the room. I saw my grandma sleeping with her old straw broom, but she didn't know what she was doing. She could hardly understand. That she was really sleeping up pieces of a man. Saw my daddy meet the mailman, and I heard the mailman say, "Now don't you take this letter too hard now, Jimmy. They've laid off 9 others today." He didn't know what he was saying.
hardly understand. He was only talking to pieces of a man. I saw the thunder and heard the lightning and felt the burden of his shame.